At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year continuous sobriety. Have Central as your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. I've done all of those things. I was trying to figure out how to, what I wanted to say about how I wanted to qualify tonight, and I guess the best thing to do is just kind of wrap it up. I came in originally to AA when I was 25. I knew I was an alcoholic. I'd been drinking for 10 years. I did not want to quit drinking forever. I thought I was too young. So I didn't stay. I didn't work the steps, and I didn't take it to heart. But at least I was introduced to AA. At 29, I got cancer, and I couldn't stop drinking through chemo. And anyway, I decided that might be a problem after I got done with chemo. So I came back in, and I stayed sober for about 4.5 years, mainly because I liked the benefits of being sober. But again, I hadn't smashed the idea that I could drink like other people. I thought eventually I would be able to do that. So I went back out for 10 years. I'm one of the lucky people that actually came back after 10 years of drinking. So, I had to lose everything, including my job. It's just literally anything that was important to me, I lost it. I was homeless, not employed. Spiritually bankrupt when I came in. So to sum that up today, I had a little training I had to go to, but I mean, I have two jobs today. The obsession drink has been lifted for me anyway from day one. I pray every day for the obsession to drink to be taken away from me, and it has been. And it's only because I've done the work this time, and I knew that I had the gift of desperation when I came back in. So I did work the steps. And still do every day, and you know, you just don't ever have to drink again is the end of my story, and I'm much happier. That's that. Okay, and I need to introduce the speaker tonight. Chuck is our speaker tonight, and I met Chuck after he'd been sober for a couple of weeks and been to other meetings, but I came in August of 2012, and there's only three of us from the time when I came in that are still here. There were people here when we got here that are still here, but of the people that came in at the same time, we were the only three out of about 50. It's pretty stark statistics, but Chuck doesn't know this, but in week three of him coming to Central, I noticed a tremendous change in him, and I believe he had a spiritual experience of some sort, but he got involved and in the middle of everything. And one of the reasons that I want him to speak tonight is because we all have different stories. We have extremely different stories. I had extremely low bottom. His wasn't near quite that low, but it's always the same. And the feelings are the same. And he does the deal and works the program every day, and he's my best little friend. So here's Seth.
Through everything here really quick, and then I'll get started. All right, my name is Chuck, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really, really nervous. There's a lot of you here. Something was said to me before the meeting by an old friend that it takes a village to raise a Chuck, and you guys are definitely my village. You know, everyone in this room, whether I've met you or not, whether you know you've been to this meeting or not, have helped me stay sober for the last 16 months, and I'm sober today, and I'm very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a member of the Central Group. I'm just going to get started. My sobriety date is August 15th, 2012. I am really nervous. I spoke once before, and I wasn't as nervous, but this is home, so this is a little more. August 15th, 2012. What it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, all right? So, well, I'm going to start at the beginning. I was born almost 40 years ago to a Cuban immigrant mother and an Irish Protestant father. And, you know, my early upbringing was, I was born up north in Baltimore. My early upbringing was, you know, not memorable. I mean, there was nothing really happened. I think the worst thing that I can remember happening at 4 or 5 years old was, I remember my, I said this once before, my grandparents or my grandparents up there had a little birthday party for me, I think when I turned 4, and they put the birthday cake up on the top of the hood, and my parents took off, you know, with the birthday cake on the hood, and it splattered all over the windshield. I mean, that was like one of the most traumatic events of the first maybe, you know, 10 years of my childhood. You know, and it was very nondescript. There's not much I can really say about it, you know. That's just how it was. And we moved to Florida. My mother was pregnant with my sister. My dad was in construction. He had to, you know, get a job down here. The recession of the 70s had taken its toll on the construction industry up there, so we ended up in Florida. My grandfather had facilitated him getting a job here. And we moved down here. Again, I would say up until maybe my 12th or 13th birthday, I don't remember anything extreme happening. You know, I had a pretty average childhood up until that point, you know. I don't even remember ever seeing my parents drink. I mean, they probably did. They probably, you know, they probably had people over, have parties, and maybe they got drunk. I don't really know. But I don't remember it ever being an issue until around my 12th year. What happened, the first time that I remember, I mean, I had tasted alcohol as a child. I had, you know, been given wine at dinner as a very young child. I don't consider that really my first drunk. The first time I got drunk was when I was 13 years old in Spain with my grandparents, and but I liked it. I mean, it wasn't one of those things where I had a blackout, and, you know, it was awesome. I wanted more of it. The only thing that happened was we were stuck on a tour bus, and I had to piss really bad, and they wouldn't stop the bus for me. But other than that, that was the only consequence of drinking for me at that point. But a little bit before that, to back up a little bit, I grew up out in Brevard County on the Space Coast. And in January of 1986, the Challenger exploded. And my dad was in construction over there. Well, for anyone who's not from this area, they may not know, but that Brevard County, that entire area has always been heavily dependent, almost completely dependent on the space industry, on NASA. And so when that happened, the economy in that area just went down the tubes. And my dad at that time had his own company, and had to declare bankruptcy and went through all this. And that's when I remember noticing my mother was different. You know, there were nights where she was sleeping on the back porch and not coming inside. My dad would lock her out, and it was just really bizarre stuff happening. You know, and then my dad explained to me that my mother was drunk, and I didn't understand what that meant initially. But, you know, after not too long, I got it, you know. My childhood at that point, from that point forward, it took a pretty sharp turn. You know, it became an abusive household, you know, from physical and verbal abuse to, you know, my dad chasing us around with a gun and all this stuff. It was just not a great scene, not a great scene, you know. But there's a lot of people who tell, you know, I don't think that has anything to do with my alcoholism, you know, because people come up here and speak and they share meetings. They came from normal, you know, childhoods. It's not why I drank. It's not what caused me to drink. I think had certain events not happened, possibly my parents wouldn't have been as bad. I don't know. It's hard to say. But, you know, it's just part of what has shaped me. You know, I think those first early nurturing years are the reason why I'm quasi-successful in life at all, you know, as one of my many therapists has told me. But that's basically what it was. And I managed to get through high school. You know, one of the other issues that I dealt with, and I'm just going to put this right out there really, you know, because it's a big part of my life. I'm gay, and I was a gay teenager, and I was really, you know, struggling with that issue, especially growing up out in Titusville, very conservative, very, you know, I was in church a lot. I went to mass. I'm Catholic, and, you know, struggled with my identity a lot, and it, you know, really just the way I grew up and everything that was going on, it was a nice little pressure cooker that was building up steam for me over the years. And then when I graduated high school, even before I graduated high school, I began to start dipping into my parents' whiskey supply and stuff on a regular basis. I would, drink to sleep. I mean, I had a lot of anxiety. I would, you know, use alcohol, really not recreationally. I mean, I would go out and party and stuff like that with friends and drink, but I would also use my parents' liquor, and I would refill the bottle with, you know, a combination of water and apple juice or whatever to try and, you know, hide that I was taking their booze. But or times where I told them I poured out their booze because I was so angry that they were alcoholic, you know, and I was actually the one who drank it, you know. So, and that's the way it was. But, you know, I could do it. I could go a few days without doing it. It hadn't really had a grip on me. It didn't have a grip on me yet. But I think, you know, I had developed a really negative identity of my really low self-esteem, you know, had body issues and stuff like that. And one of the first time I got, I've really never been hospitalized as a direct result of my alcoholism, but as an indirect result, yes. When I was 19, I ended up, I got down to about 169 pounds, and I was this tall, and I had this stature, because when I would drink, I would do it intentionally to get to a point where I would, where the contents of my stomach would return. I did it on purpose, in order to, you know, to lose weight, and of course, it was the effect of the alcohol was a nice bonus to it, too. And I ended up passing out at work, and they had to take me to the hospital and all this. And, of course, I wasn't honest with anyone. I just thought I had I've got a stomach bug, and maybe I'm dieting a little too aggressively. And, you know, so that, you know, who wants to admit that they've got a problem, especially when you're 19 years old and your 20s are ahead of you. You know, it's like the party hasn't even gotten started yet. I wasn't even legally allowed to drink. But I was able to kind of dial it back. You know, that was scary. It was a scary health thing. I put some weight back on, started working out. I started going out to bars and clubs and having a good time. And I don't know, I guess when I came out around that age, there was an exhilaration. There was a sense of acceptance when I started going out and being in the gay community. And the party was fun for a while. I mean, it really, truly was. I have a lot of pleasant experiences drinking at that time, all up into my early 30s, you know, even mid-30s, that were fun. And I don't regret them. I mean, it was what it was. But it, you know, it turned on me, and it turned on me pretty bad. I'm going to just sort of fast forward a little bit. A lot of, you know, things happen in life. But what ended up bringing me to AA, I had a long-term relationship that had come to an end. And you know, my only coping skill in life for any problem that I ever had was always alcohol. You know, it was the reason to party, and it was the reason to, it was the only thing, it's what I used to escape. It's the only, because I couldn't cope with it. I've never been able to, I've had this inability all my life to, I don't want to say solve problems, but just cope with life and deal with life's normal ups and downs. I just couldn't do it, so I wanted to check out, you know. And, you know, coming up, you know, to last year when all these things happened, I would do that, and I'd become this spastic mess that people would have to come in and kind of scoop me up and rescue me because I got them to feel sorry for me. You know, it was a pattern that was consistent throughout my 20s and early 30s, you know. But, you know, with the drinking, I met my former partner in a bar, and it was a good time, and it was a lot of fun, you know. But he was able to kind of always stop, and I didn't always want to stop, and I didn't always wasn't honest when he thought we both stopped. And, it just kind of continued on. But I could still dial it back. But when that relationship ended, that really kind of threw me for a curve. That was a curveball thrown at me. And I had no sense of identity outside of being with another person because I depended on another person to survive, to subsist, to think for me, to do everything for me, but, you know, wipe my ass. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I thought my world was coming to an end. So the drinking really began to escalate. During this time, prior to our split, we had purchased a trip to go to Europe, and I went ahead and went on it with another person. We sold the other ticket to somebody. It was a cruise, so we were able to do that, and I went on it. And this is kind of part of where you start to hit bottom. And I want to also backtrack. Before I went on this trip, I had gone to the doctor and had told him about my anxiety, but naturally I wasn't, you know. He was pressing on my stomach here, and he said, "Do you feel that?" And I said, "No, not really." And he's like, "Well, you know, that feels like you might have a little bit of a fatty liver going on, you know, because your liver enzymes or whatever are just, you know, through the roof." And I'm like, "Well, it must be all the sweets I'm eating or something. I mean, I said, well, I don't know. I said, yeah, I like to have a few beers. That typical bullshit, you know. And so I got him to prescribe me, and I'm not going to shy away from this because it's in our literature. It's in Bill's story, you know, combining alcohol with sedative. It's right there at the beginning of our text. And I definitely did that, and that's when it became its darkest for me. I was able to kind of taper off the drinking by using what was prescribed to me, but I was using it at an accelerated rate more than what naturally was prescribed, so I figured out, you know, doctor shopping is much easier than you would imagine it to be. I mean, this is what became of me, you know, and so I procured more of it. I was able to do that. And then I decided, you know, when I came back from, you know, well, I decided to start mixing it, but I don't remember there was like a day where I said, I'm just going to do this and see what happens. I mean, I knew what was going to happen. But I started mixing it, and one day when I was over toward the end of my vacation, at the end of this trip that I took, I had 3 days alone in Germany before I had to come home. The person that I went on the trip with was sick of me because I was batshit crazy mess on that cruise. I mean, he still doesn't really speak to me right now, but I really ruined his vacation. But in any event, those last 3 days that I was, I spent them in Hamburg, Germany, alone, and those 3 days were probably the most alone I've ever felt in my life. I know that I don't think loneliness is something that's unique to alcoholics at all. I think that the loneliness that we alcoholics experience and feel, especially when we're active in our disease, is definitely something that's indescribable that only we get, that only we can understand. And I just went on a 3-day bender where it was the first time I ever experienced what, you know, I found out was a blackout. I'm not going to get graphic. But suffice it to say that I allowed things to be done to me and end up in places that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is definitely a good description for. And, you know, I don't know how I got back to my hotel all 3 nights that I was there. I have no recollection. I mean, I mean, Hamburg is a huge city geographically to get around, you know, and I was out all hours of the night. No clue how I got back. I mean, I have bits and pieces of memories now that have kind of surfaced, but I still don't know how I got back to my hotel. I just woke up there all 3 days in a row somehow. But you know, that wasn't enough. I came home. Drinking my problems away didn't work. They were all still here when I got home, you know. And the last 6 weeks or so of my drinking were probably just a constant daily thing. I never, ever. I mean, my mother died of this disease at 57 years old, and I used to judge her so harshly for doing this to herself and doing this to her family, and how selfish it was of her to drink and to abandon her husband, to abandon her children. And here I was, the exact same addict and alcoholic that my mother turned out I turned out just like my mother, you know, and I couldn't stop. I had reached a point that I thought I'd never get to where I didn't know how to stop drinking. It was not possible for me to go more than 11 hours without putting alcohol into my system. And that was with taking the sedatives. And I was just doing really crazy stuff. I was urinating on the back porch in my pants, falling asleep, waking up, you know, hobbling into bed, just doing some bizarre stuff, driving all over creation. I mean, early in the evening, you know, after work some days, I mean, and I know a lot of you can relate to this, the times that, I mean, I had driven drunk plenty of times before that, and never managed to get a DUI, and boy, did I deserve it then. But the times that I drove in the last 2 months of my active alcoholism, how I didn't wrap my car around a pole or take out a family in a van is just beyond me. I had no business being on the roads, none. You know, I was drinking at work, I was drinking, you know, on the weekends what I would do is I would sleep till like maybe 11:30, 11:45, so I could say at noon, I could start drinking at noon, 12:30, and say, I don't drink in the morning, you know? So even though I'd been up drinking till 4 o'clock, it just, you know, I was able to rationalize it any way that I wanted to. But it just continued on like that, It got darker, got lonelier. Started missing days at work. And I really just didn't know what I was going to do. I had no way out. I didn't know how I was going to get out of the situation I was at home, because I was still living with this person. And, you know, it was just, I had created this big nightmare for myself. Well, one night, and I believe it was a Tuesday, it was my usual deal. I was out, you know, sitting on the back porch by myself, staring out into deep space. And I just went to bed. You know, it was 2 o'clock. I managed to get to bed somehow. And at 2 o'clock, I woke up, and for whatever reason, I reached for my cell phone. It was on this table next to my bed, and I just fell right out of bed. And which had happened before. It wasn't anything that hadn't happened many times. I'd fallen plenty of times, you know. Shit, I just fell down in the bathroom earlier. Oh, that was something else I wanted to say. Robin had told me to, you know, she said, every time I speak, Chuck, I always say a prayer. I do it on the dirty bathroom floor. So I went to the men's room earlier tonight, and I'm trying to be all prostrate, and because I don't pray like that. I'm not a hit your knees kind of guy. I pray more than I ever prayed before now, but I'm still not very ceremonial about it. So I went in there to go kneel and pray, and I looked at the floor. I'm like, well, I'm not kneeling on this floor. You know? So I was squatting in the bathroom earlier, and I'm just trying to, like, God, please give me all the words I need to say, yada, yada, yada. And I started to say a third step prayer. And while I'm sitting there doing that, you know, next to the toilet, some of you who go to Central a lot know recently we've had some issues with the plumbing. And as I'm trying to do the third step prayer, the toilet starts bubbling all of a sudden. And I thought, maybe I'm taking myself a little too seriously. That's probably what this is a sign of. So I said, okay, God's got it. I'll be all right. You know. And it's a very inappropriate place in my story to mention it, but I wanted to get that out there. That was very important. So in any event, that I fell out of bed, and for whatever reason, I woke up the next morning just riddled with fear and knowing that that something was really, really wrong, that I knew I needed help. I didn't know where I was going to get the help. I didn't know who was going to help me, but I knew I needed help. I knew something that this had to stop, because this was not going to end well. So my ex happens to be a nurse, and he kind of nursed me through the 4 days before I went to my first meeting. I promised him I would go to an AA meeting, and I got to tell you, you know, we're friends today, and I'm grateful for it, because those 4 days were terrifying, miserable days. And, you know, I'll always be grateful to have had that support for that time and many months afterward. But those first 4 days for me, I was grateful to be where I was, because it got me through, you know, the shakes and so forth. And then finally, I decided I'm going to go to AA, but I had no idea what AA was about, except I had gone to a meeting back in 2002 because a little voice inside my head had told me once or twice that maybe I might have a problem with alcohol. And I went in to a meeting back, I think it was back in 2002, and it was a smoker at that time, and I was a smoker this week too for a few days. I go back and forth with it. But, you know, it was a smoker's meeting, and they had brought in, you know, the druggy buggy. And I was sitting there, you know, with these people who were chain smoking. Of course, I'm chain smoking with them. But, and I'm looking at these people who are, you know, brought in from a treatment center. I'm not sure where they were from. And I'm like, I'm nothing like these people. You know, I had put myself on this pedestal that I'm different. You know, I'm not that kind of an alcoholic. I'm obviously not a drug addict. You know, that was what I thought. And I went to a couple more meetings. I picked up a white chip, but I never even knew what the 12 steps were. I never got into it at all. I don't really consider that a real shot at this. You know, it's not until I got here this time. But in, you know, August 15th was the first day that I didn't put a drink into my, was the last time I put alcohol into my system of last year. And a few days later, I went to my first AA meeting. It was up the street here at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. It's Wake Up Call. It's at 10 o'clock on Sunday is when I went. And what's really funny is it was really kind of my ex that sort of 12-stepped me, and he didn't really even know he was doing it, because he had set me up on a date with this guy who has got like 26 years in the program. And I met him, and I could tell that this guy was trying to feel out if I was an alcoholic, and then I just decided I wanted nothing to do with him, because this guy wanted me to, he wasn't pushing anything on me, but I just knew he was an AA, and you people, this is a cult, and I didn't want anything to do with it. And you know, and so, but I ended up calling that guy, and I said, you know, I think I am going to go to an AA meeting. And so I went in there, and the great thing about that meeting was, at that particular meeting at least, and they may do it on some of the others, is they break off the newcomers, or at that time they did, and they took them into a separate little room. And they had a few people that had some time in the program, and the new people in there. I was like the only one of two new people in there. And I don't remember what I said. I just remember that I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. And all I felt was love coming back from these people. And every single person in that room understood exactly what it was that I was feeling. And, you know, because I was intent on drinking still at that point, I thought, well, I've gone 4 days. I can probably do it again, you know, and I can control it probably this time. I've, you know, got 4 days. I'll be all right. But, you know, I don't know. There was some sort of unself. I can't explain it. Just, you guys know what I'm talking about that have been here a little while. There was just this pure love that I felt from these people that had no hidden agenda. And I decided to go to breakfast with them. I collected a few phone numbers. I started calling people. I started finding out where meetings were. And the first couple of weeks before Tracy met me, I actually went solely to this one place. It's called Made a Beginning. It's a great meeting up off of Robinson. But it's a small meeting. And nothing wrong with it at all. I still will go in there once in a while. But I kind of got – I'd come here once. I'd come to Central and sat in the back very early on, and this is the most intimidating place. You know, it was very gritty, and the street people were here and all this stuff. And I wanted to be at the Unitarian Church, you know, with all the progressives. So that's where I did it. But it was nice, and they were really friendly. But for this alcoholic, it wasn't doing the trick. So I'm like, well, I'm going to go back to that Central place what happened actually one night was the traffic was really bad, and I work up in Lake Marion. I was trying to get down to that place, and I just couldn't make it. I'm like, well, I'll just go to that. You know, my sponsor says I really need to try to go to a meeting every day for a while. And, you know, he's not a 90-90 type of guy. He's very old school AA. But he did say I really should put myself into a lot of meetings and just sort of listen. And so that's what I tried to do. So I'm like, well, if I'm going to make a meeting, I'm not going to make that one on time. And I wanted to be on time. I mean, I wanted to be on time to the meeting because I thought, you know, my sponsor would, I don't know what I thought he would do. I didn't know what kind of powers he actually had. I wasn't sure. But to eject me from Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I'm like, I got to get to meeting on time. So I remember where this place was, and I came into Central. That was like the second time I came to Central. And then what was interesting is I saw my old bartender here from a place I used to go for a long time. And I'm like, no shit, you know. And he has, you know, decades in the program too. I'm like, this floored me. But seeing him here, and he came up and talked to me, and, you know, he couldn't remember my name, but he recognized me from the copious amounts of booze I'd bought over the years, and, you know, and I'm sure I tipped him well because he came up and said hi to me. But he came up to me and talked to me, and you know, he brought me back to that other meeting, encouraged me to keep coming here, to have me come to the Candlelight meeting, came to the speaker meeting, and this place sort of grew on me, and and Central ultimately became my home group, you know, and it is to this day, you know. But I think if I hadn't seen him here that night, I don't know. It's hard to say what would have happened. I no longer believe in coincidences in life at all, of any sort. I think that everything does happen for a reason, even some of the worst stuff that happens. All of the things that we go through. It's impossible to see it usually while you're going through it, and you have to trust that. You know, I have faith that later on, and when there's some distance in the rear view, it's a little clearer. But he gave me my big book, and you know, and he's not around right now. He moved, but you know, I'm really grateful for him. But I just started coming to meetings. I, you know, started listening to what you guys were saying, and you know, I don't know what she thought my spiritual experience was, but I'll tell you a little funny story early on before I start getting into what action I've been doing. One night, we were talking about this the other day, I was sitting, when the chairs are arranged in the normal fashion in here, there's two rows along that wall, and I was sitting back over there, I remember, and I thought that, you know, I'd heard the nine step promises read, you know, several times, and I misinterpreted the part about financial insecurity. I thought that that meant that I would get rich. And so I had, one night when I was drunk, I had decided it was a good idea to buy Madonna tickets. And this is when she figured out I was gay too, by the way. And I didn't realize I got, she was like, oh snap, he's gay. But
I thought that, you know, the promises were coming true, because not only did I sell my Madonna tickets that I bought when I was drunk, I made money off of them, and I just had this wonderful spiritual experience. Like, I would just love to hear a recording of some of the crap that came out of my mouth the first several couple of months that I was here, because I didn't know what I was saying. But, you know, when I hear newcomers come in, I try to be patient and listen to those things, because they say all the similar things, too. When we all get here, we're all, you know, grasping for something. We're all wanting to have that, you know, and you know, our literature talks about the spiritual experience versus spiritual awakening, and mine is the more of the educational variety. It's happening slowly over time, but you know, I just think the newcomer needs a lot of patience a lot of the time, because it takes a while to get this. I'm only 16 months sober, you know, and I hope I never get this. I hope I never reach a point where I don't feel new, because where I feel like I've got this thing, because I think that's when I'm going to be in big trouble. But you know, so I got into, you know, what I was working through my steps. I started, a friend of mine got me to come to a group conscious meeting. And if you're new, I really recommend that you come to a group conscious meeting for a couple of reasons. It's really, you know, cool to see how this works and how AA operates, because it's nothing like what I thought. It's the, you know, the nuts get to run the asylum. And it's, you know, pretty amazing how we do function, you know. And I come to almost every business meeting, you know, when I can, and for no other reason, just come for the show. I mean, it's just awesome. I mean, you know, bring your 3D glasses and your popcorn, because it's really something, you know. But it's very important. You know, I don't want to make light of it, because without the trusted servants that we have in AA, you know, these groups wouldn't operate. They would cease to function. And you know, you learn about the traditions by coming to the meetings, and you know, and I'm still learning a lot, you know. But I got into service. I started chairing a meeting and was working through my steps as diligently as I thought I could. I don't know if I did them right, but I'm sober, so something must have stuck. Where I began to really start to understand what AA was about, you know, first of all, I found God in this room. I thought I knew God. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I understood what God was. God created the world and everything in it, but hated me, you know. And for whatever reason, he had singled me out to punish me. You know, I was defective. And, you know, that's what I thought God was, not a benevolent being, but this creator who made this mistake called Chuck. And, you know, that's what I felt. That's how I felt my entire life. And coming here and working this program and being in this fellowship, and it's hard to put into words, it really is, but I don't believe that of myself anymore. I have bad days. I had a shitty week, you know. This week I almost lost my job because of my big mouth. You know, I said something very inappropriate at work, but you know, I got through it sober. I mean, that's something that I could never have gotten through on my own, you know, without the people in this program, the friends that I have, and God. You know, I don't think it's a mistake that it happened. It made me kind of raw this week. You know, that's why I talk about getting the cigarettes. You know, I tell you, you know, the obsession to drink has been lifted. Do I think about it? Absolutely. You know, that when I found out I was going to meet with the head of the organization, I was like, sorry. I was just like, you know, it would just be so easy to just check out. You know, that's the thing that goes through my mind. Just that. Temporary relief that alcohol does bring, you know. And I went right into the 7-Eleven. I immediately bought a pack of Marlboros, you know. And I, you know, it was gone within 2 minutes. I mean, I was smoking like a chimney for 4 days, but you know, I didn't drink, and I did use some of the tools. I didn't do it perfectly, you know. But I talked to another alcoholic. I talked to other people. I didn't make some rash decisions that I was going to make. I got through it, you know, and I'm here tonight. And that's a miracle for this neurotic being, you know. It's just crazy. But what I want to say is, for me, what I get the most out of personally out of this program is sponsorship and talking to the newcomer. I think that when this all comes down to brass tacks, it's bringing someone through the steps. It's talking to that new person that walks in the door that's scared. Even if they just barely acknowledge you and they just keep walking, you know, what I'm trying to apply this in my life after this week at work, but, you know, but just I just continue to smile at them and tell them to come back, you know, and that we want them back. And even if they drink over and over and over again and relapse over and over and over again, you know, you guys welcome them back with we welcome them back with open arms here. We don't, you know, what does Robin say? We don't shoot our wounded. You know, it's just it's beautiful. It's a beautiful part of this program. And that's how I found God. That's how I found a creator that I know has to love me, because he loves all of you, and it just comes right out. You know, and that's the person I aspire to be today. Do I work this program perfectly? Hell no. You know, there are days where, you know, I try my best to do a 10th step and, you know, 11th step most days. I forget, you know. I get caught up in my own head. It seems like when I'm working with a sponsee, though, I tend to be a lot more diligent about doing things, and none of my sponsees, but all but one, are back out, you know. But I think I've taken like 6 guys through the steps, and, you know, I took the first one so personally. But what was interesting about that first one who went back out was I ran into him one night with a friend of mine who isn't here this evening, but I was picking him up to bring him to a meeting. He was staying at the domiciliary, the VA domiciliary, and he and I had to stop, and I needed gas, and he needed to get cigarettes or whatever. And, you know, I could smell the odor of alcohol. Like, you know, you know what it smells like on a person when they're just reeking of it, you know, when we were just reeking of it. And I could smell it behind me, but I didn't think much of it because it was that mobile station next to that hotel up on 50, and I'm like, this is just the neighborhood that we're in. And I just hear, "Hey, Chuck." I look back as the very first guy that I was sponsoring with, you know, holding a 4-pack, and I knew that he was back out. I mean, I knew that already. And I just kind of remember, you know, we exchanged, you know, pleasantries, and I just, you know, to this day I kind of wish I'd offered him, you know, we were on our way to a meeting. I'm like, I still now wish I'd offered him a ride to Central. You know, I didn't do that night. And I remember watching him walk off into the distance, and I just started to sob, you know. But I could tell how lonely he was, and that's how I felt when I got in here. And I pray that he comes back, you know, because I know you guys will welcome him back, you know. I'm not sure what else to share about. It's a little early, but, you know, with only 16, you know, with a 20-plus year drinking career and only 16 months sober, I'm certainly not going to sit up here and, you know, pontificate about the program, because I have so much that I still have to learn. But what I wanted to read was a couple of things for you. When I first started coming to Central, when they read at the end of the meeting, that, you know, our 12th tradition is every meeting I've been to, I'm not sure if it's just at Central, but they always do the 12th tradition. But at that time, they were doing the long form of the 12th tradition, and I'm not meaning to stir up stuff for group conscience here, because I know that gets changed back and forth and all this. But I, you know, I have no opinion on whether or not this ever gets changed back again. But I will say that for me, this resonated for me when I heard it read. And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility, this to the end that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And the other thing, before I got to speak one other time, and this just leapt out of the page. I'm one of those readers, I can go to movies and see them 20 times and I can't remember one single line of dialogue, unless, there's a few movies that I do, you know, but some people can just watch a movie once or read a book and they can just, you know, I can't do this. I've read the big book like 6 times and I'm like, huh? You know, people say stuff and I they have page numbers memorized. Like, I have like 4 page numbers memorized. But this is one, and this is the kind of the way I just want to leave it. And this is really what the program means to me. This best, I think, summarizes how I feel about this fellowship. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. One, once confused, baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God today is the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Thank you for letting me share.